Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Bell Curve, Intelligence and Class Structure in American Life by Richard J. Hernstein and Charles Murray. Richard J. Hernstein received his Ph.D. in psychology at Harvard, where he began teaching in 1958, and where he held the Edgar Pierce Chair in Psychology until his death in 1994. Charles Murray is a graduate of Harvard and received his Ph.D. in political science from MIT. Currently a Bradley Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, he is the author of Losing Ground, American Social Policy, 1950 to 1980. Here is Charles Murray.
This audio program is about differences in intellectual capacity among people and groups and what those differences mean for America's future. The relationships that Richard Hernstein and I will be examining here are among the most sensitive in contemporary America, so sensitive that hardly anyone writes about them or talks about them in public. It's not for lack of information, as you will see. On the contrary, knowledge about the connections between intelligence and American life has been accumulating for years, available in the journals held by any good university library and on the computer tapes and disks of public-use databases. People have shied away from the topic for many reasons. Some think that the concept of intelligence has been proved a fraud. Others recall totalitarian eugenic schemes based on IQ scores, or worry about such schemes arising once the subject breaks into the open. Many fear that discussing intelligence will promote racism. The friends and colleagues whose concerns we take most seriously say something like this: "Yes, we acknowledge that intelligence is important and that people differ, but the United States is founded on the principle that people should be equal under the law. So what possible relevance can individual differences in intelligence have to public policy?" In answer, we ask these friends and you, the listener, to share for a moment our view of the situation, perhaps suppressing some doubts and assuming as true things that we will subsequently try to prove are true. Here is our story. A great nation, founded on principles of individual liberty and self-government that constitute the crowning achievement of statecraft, approaches the end of the 20th century. Equality of rights has been implanted more deeply and more successfully than in any other society in history. Yet even as the principle of equal rights triumphs, strange things begin to happen to two small segments of the population. In one segment, life gets better in many ways. The people in this group are welcomed at the best colleges, then at the best graduate and professional schools, regardless of their parents' wealth. After they complete their education, they enter fulfilling and prestigious careers. Their incomes continue to rise, even when income growth stagnates for everyone else. Technology works in their behalf, expanding their options and their freedom, putting unprecedented resources at their command, enhancing their ability to do what they enjoy doing. And as these good things happen to them, they gravitate to one another, increasingly enabled by their affluence and by technology to work together and live in one another's company and in isolation from everybody else. In the other group, life gets worse, and its members collect at the bottom of society. Poverty is severe, drugs and crime are rampant, and the traditional family all but disappears. Economic growth passes them by. Technology is not a partner in their lives, but an electronic opiate. They live together in urban centers or scattered in rural backwaters, but their presence hovers over the other parts of town and countryside as well, creating fear and resentment in the rest of society that is seldom openly expressed, but festers nonetheless. Pressures from these contrasting movements at the opposite ends of society put terrific stress on the entire structure. Numerically, the people at each end are a small minority of the overall population. The mass of the nation is in the center, and the resulting pattern is known as a bell curve. In America today, the lives of the majority in the center are increasingly shaped by the power of the fortunate few and the plight of the despairing few. The culture's sense of what is right and wrong, virtuous and mean, attainable and unattainable, most important, its sense of how people are to live together, is altered in myriad ways. The fragile web of civility, mutual regard, and mutual obligations at the heart of any happy society begins to tear. In trying to think through what is happening and why, and in trying to understand thereby what ought to be done, the nation's social scientists and journalists and politicians seek explanations. They examine changes in the economy changes in demographics, changes in the culture. They propose solutions founded on better education, on more and better jobs, on specific social interventions. But they ignore an underlying element that has shaped the changes, human intelligence. The way it varies within the American population and its crucially changing role in our destinies during the last half of the 20th century. To try to come to grips with a nation's problems without understanding the role of intelligence is to see through a glass darkly indeed, to grope with symptoms instead of causes, to stumble into supposed remedies that have no chance of working. We are not indifferent to the ways in which our research, wrongly construed, might do harm. We have worried about this from the day we began work. But there can be no real progress in solving America's social problems when they are as misperceived as they are today. What good can come of understanding the relationship of intelligence to social structure and public policy? Little good can come without it. That the word intelligence describes something real, and that it varies from person to person, is as universal and ancient as any understanding about the state of being human. Literate cultures everywhere and throughout history have had words for saying that some people are smarter than others. Given the survival value of intelligence, the concept must be still older than that. Gossip about who in the tribe is cleverest has probably been a topic of conversation around the fire since fires and conversation were invented. Yet for the last 30 years, the concept of intelligence has been a pariah in the world of ideas. The attempt to measure it with tests has been variously dismissed as an artifact of racism, political reactions, statistical bungling, and scholarly fraud. By the 1960s and 1970s, it had somehow become controversial to claim, especially in public, that genes had any effect at all on intelligence. The causes of human deficiencies in intelligence, or parenting, or social behavior, or work behavior, lay outside the individual. They were caused by flaws in society. Sometimes capitalism was blamed. Sometimes an uncaring or incompetent government. Further, the causes of these deficiencies could be fixed by the right public policies. Redistribution of wealth, better education, better housing, and medical care. Once these environmental causes were removed, the deficiencies should vanish as well, it was argued. The contrary notion, that individual differences could not be easily diminished by government intervention, collided head-on with the enthusiasm for egalitarianism, which itself collided head-on with a half-century of IQ data indicating that differences in intelligence are in fact intractable and significantly heritable, and that the average IQ of various socioeconomic and ethnic groups differs. How much is IQ a matter of genes? The state of knowledge does not permit a precise estimate, but half a century of work, now amounting to hundreds of empirical and theoretical studies, permits a broad conclusion that the genetic component of IQ is unlikely to be smaller than 40% or higher than 80%. The most unambiguous direct estimates, based on identical twins raised apart, produce some of the highest estimates of heritability. For purposes of this discussion, we will adopt a middling estimate of 60% heritability, which, by extension, means that IQ is about 40% a matter of environment. The balance of the evidence suggests that 60% may err on the low side. In analyzing these issues, our focus will be on the relationship of human abilities to public policy. We will be dealing in relationships that are based on aggregated data. For example, suppose the topic is two 11-year-olds, one with an IQ of 110 and one with an IQ of 90. We are asked, what can you tell about the difference between those two children? The answer must be phrased very tentatively. On many important topics, the answer must be, we can tell you nothing with any confidence. It is well worth a guidance counselor's time to know what these individual scores are, but only in combination with a variety of other information about the child's personality, talents, and background. The individual's IQ score all by itself is a useful tool, but a limited one. Suppose instead that the question at issue is, given two sixth grade classes, one for which the average IQ is 110 and the other for which it is 90, what can you tell us about the difference between those two classes and their average prospects for the future? Now there is a great deal to be said, and it can be said with considerable confidence, not about any one person in either class, but about the average outcomes that are important to the school, educational policy in general, and society writ large. This makes a point so important that we will say it now and repeat it later. Measures of intelligence have reliable statistical relationships with important social phenomena, but they are a limited tool for deciding what to make of any given individual. The IQ score reveals little about whether the human being next to you is someone whom you will admire or cherish. This thing we know as IQ is important, but not a synonym for human excellence. The very word intelligence carries with it undue affect and political baggage. It is still a useful word, but we shall subsequently employ the more neutral term cognitive ability as often as possible to refer to the concept that we have hitherto called intelligence. This, we hope, will help you think of intelligence as just a noun, not an accolade. The 21st century will open on a world in which cognitive ability is the decisive dividing force. Social class remains the vehicle of social life, but intelligence now pulls the train, led by a distinct stratum in the social hierarchy, which we hereby dub the cognitive elite. Stratification by cognitive ability has been weak and inconsistent until this century, because the number of very bright people was so much greater than the specialized jobs for which high intelligence is indispensable. A true cognitive elite requires a technological society. This raises a distinction that is worth emphasizing. To say that most of the people in the cognitively demanding positions of a society have a high IQ is not the same as saying that most of the people with high IQs are in such positions. It is possible to have cognitive screening without having cognitive classes. Mathematical necessity tells us that a large majority of the smart people in ancient Egypt, dynastic China, Elizabethan England, and Teddy Roosevelt's America were engaged in ordinary pursuits, mingling, working, and living with everyone else. Many were housewives. Most of the rest were farmers, smiths, millers, and shopkeepers. Social and economic stratification was extreme, but cognitive stratification was minor. So it has been from the beginning of history into this century. Then, comparatively rapidly, with the rise of technology, a new class structure emerged in which it became much more consistently and universally advantageous to be smart. Now, we will examine that process and its meaning. In the course of the 20th century, America opened the doors of its colleges wider than any previous generation of Americans or any other society in history could have imagined possible. The growth in the proportion of people getting college degrees is the most obvious result, with a 15-fold increase from 1900 to 1990. Even more important, the students going to college were being selected ever more efficiently for their high IQ. The crucial decade was the 1950s, when the percentage of top students who went to college rose by more than it had in the preceding three decades. By the beginning of the 1990s, about 80% of all students in the top quartile of ability continued to college after high school. Among the high school graduates in the top few percentiles of cognitive ability, the chance of going to college exceeded 90%. Perhaps the most important of all the changes was the transformation of America's elite colleges. Starting in the 1950s, a handful of institutions became magnets for the very brightest of each year's new class. In these schools, the cognitive level of the students rose far above the rest of the college population. Taken together, these trends have stratified America according to cognitive ability. Education is a powerful divider and classifier. Education affects income, and income divides. Education affects occupation, and occupation divides. Education affects tastes and interests, grammar and accent, all of which divide. When access to higher education is restricted by class, race, or religion, these divisions cut across cognitive levels. But school is in itself, more immediately and directly than any other institution, the place where people of high cognitive ability excel, and where people of low cognitive ability fail. As America opened access to higher education, it opened up as well a revolution in the way that the American population sorted itself and divided itself. The news about education is heartening and frightening, more or less in equal measure. Heartening, because the nation is providing college education for a high proportion of those who could profit from it. Frightening, because when people live in encapsulated worlds, it becomes difficult for them, even with the best of intentions, to grasp the realities of the worlds with which they have little experience, but over which they also have great influence, both public and private. Many of those promising undergraduates are never going to live in a community where they will be disabused of their misperceptions. For after education comes another sorting mechanism, occupation. And many of the holes that are still left in the cognitive partitions begin to get sealed, because people in different jobs have different average IQs. Whatever the reason for the link between IQ and occupation, it goes deep. If you want to guess an adult male's job status, the results of his childhood IQ test help you as much as knowing how many years he went to school. IQ becomes more important as the job gets intellectually tougher. To be able to dig a ditch, you need a strong back but not necessarily a high IQ score. To be a master carpenter, you need some higher degree of intelligence along with skill with your hands. To be a first-rate lawyer, you had better come from the upper end of the cognitive ability distribution. The same may be said of a handful of other occupations, such as accountants, engineers and architects, college teachers, dentists and physicians, mathematicians and scientists. The mean IQ of people entering those fields is in the neighborhood of 120. In 1900, only 1 out of 20 people in the top 10% of intelligence were in any of these occupations, a figure that did not change much through 1940. But after 1940, more and more people with high IQs flowed into those jobs, and by 1990, the same handful of occupations employed about 25% of all the people in the top tenth of intelligence. During the same period, IQ became more important for business executives. In 1900, the CEO of a large company was likely to be a WASP born into affluence. He may have been bright, but that was not mainly how he was chosen. Much was still the same as late as 1950. The next three decades saw a great social leveling as the executive suites filled with bright people who could maximize corporate profits, and never mind if they came from the wrong side of the tracks or worshipped at a temple instead of a church. Meanwhile, the college degree became a requirement for many business positions, and graduate education went from a rarity to a commonplace among senior executives. When one combines the people known to be in high IQ professions with estimates of the numbers of business executives who are drawn from the top tenth in cognitive ability, the results do not leave much room for maneuver. The specific proportions are open to argument, but the main point seems beyond dispute. Even as recently as mid-century, America was still a society in which most bright people were scattered throughout a wide range of jobs. As the century draws to a close, a very high proportion of that same group is now concentrated within a few occupations that are highly screened for IQ. This cognitive partitioning through education and occupations will continue, and there is not much that the government or anyone else can do about it. Economics will be the main reason. At the same time that elite colleges and professional schools are turning out brighter and brighter graduates, the value of intelligence in the marketplace is rising. Wages earned by people in high IQ occupations have pulled away from the wages in low IQ occupations. Another force for cognitive partitioning is the increasing physical segregation of the cognitive elite from the rest of society. Members of the cognitive elite work in jobs that usually keep them off the shop floor, away from the construction site, and close to others who also tend to be smart. Computers and electronic communication make it increasingly likely that people who work mainly with their minds collaborate only with other such people. The isolation of the cognitive elite is compounded by its choices of where to live, shop, play, worship, and send its children to school. Its isolation is intensified by an irony of a mobile and democratic society like America's. Cognitive ability is a function of both genes and environment, with implications for egalitarian social policies. The more we succeed in giving every youngster a chance to develop his or her latent cognitive ability, the more we equalize the environmental sources of differences in intelligence. The irony is that as America equalizes the circumstances of people's lives, the remaining differences in intelligence are increasingly determined by differences in genes. Meanwhile, high cognitive ability means, more than ever before, that the chances of success in life are good and getting better all the time. Putting it all together, success and failure in the American economy, and all that goes with it, are increasingly a matter of the genes that people inherit. As Mae West said in another context, goodness has nothing to do with it. We are not talking about what should have been, but what has been. The educational system does sort by cognitive ability at the close of the 20th century in a way that it did not at the opening of the century. The upper strata of intelligence are being sucked into a comparatively few occupations in a way that they did not used to be. Cognitive ability is importantly related to job productivity. All of these trends will continue under any social policy. We are optimistic enough to believe that no administration, left or right, is going to impede the education of the brightest, or forbid the brightest from entering the most cognitively demanding occupations, or find a way to keep employers from rewarding productivity. But we are not so optimistic that we can overlook dark shadows accompanying the trends. As we move on, here is a topic to keep in the back of your mind. What if the cognitive elite were to become not only richer than everyone else, increasingly segregated, and more genetically distinct as time goes on, but were also to acquire common political interests? What might those interests be, and how congruent might they be with a free society? How decisively could the cognitive elite affect policy if it were to acquire such a common political interest? We will return to these issues later. First, we must explore the social problems that might help create such a new political coalition. How much does intelligence have to do with America's most pressing social problems? The short answer is quite a lot, and the reason is that different levels of cognitive ability are associated with different patterns of social behavior. High cognitive ability is generally associated with socially desirable behaviors, low cognitive ability with socially undesirable ones. Generally associated with does not mean coincident with. For virtually all of the topics we will be discussing, cognitive ability accounts for only small to middling proportions of the variation among people. It almost always explains less than 20% of the variance, to use the statistician's term, usually less than 10%, and often less than 5%. What this means in English is that you cannot predict what a given person will do from his IQ score, a point that we have made earlier and will make again, for it needs repeating. On the other hand, despite the low association at the individual level, large differences in social behavior separate groups of people when the groups differ intellectually on the average. We believe that intelligence itself, not just its correlation with socioeconomic status, is responsible for these group differences. Our thesis appears to be radical, judging from its neglect by other social scientists. Could low intelligence possibly be a cause of irresponsible childbearing and parenting behaviors, for example? Scholars of childbearing and parenting do not seem to think so. Could low intelligence possibly be a cause of unemployment or poverty? Only a scattering of economists have broached the possibility. This neglect points to a gaping hole in the state of knowledge about social behavior. It is not that cognitive ability has been considered and found inconsequential, but that it has barely been considered at all. We must add cognitive ability to the mix of variables that social scientists have traditionally used, clearing away some of the mystery that has surrounded the nation's most serious social problems. People must recognize that cognitive ability is an important factor in thinking about the nature of the present problems, whether or not cognitive ability is a cause. For example, if many of the single women who have babies also have low IQ, it makes no difference in one sense whether the low IQ caused them to have the babies or whether the path of causation takes a more winding route. The reality that less intelligent women have most of the out-of-wedlock babies affects and constrains public policy, whatever the path of causation. The simple correlation, unadjusted for other factors, what social scientists call the zero-order correlation between cognitive ability and social behaviors, is socially important. At this point in our analysis, we are limiting the research to whites, and more specifically to non-Latino whites. This is, we think, the best way to make yet another central point. Cognitive ability affects social behavior without regard to race or ethnicity. The influence of race and ethnicity will be dealt with later, but first we turn to an examination of poverty and other social problems among whites. Who becomes poor? One familiar answer is that people who are unlucky enough to be born to poor parents become poor. There is some truth to this. Whites who grow up in the worst 5% of socioeconomic circumstances are 8 times more likely to fall below the poverty line than those growing up in the top 5% of socioeconomic circumstances. But low intelligence is a stronger precursor of poverty than low socioeconomic background. Whites with IQs in the bottom 5% of the distribution of cognitive ability are 15 times more likely to be poor than those with IQs in the top 5%. How does each of these causes of poverty look when the other is held constant? Or, to put it another way, if you have to choose, is it better to be born smart or rich? The answer is unequivocally smart. A white youth who is reared in a home in which the parent or parents are chronically unemployed, but who has just average intelligence, an IQ of 100, has nearly 90% chance of being out of poverty by his or her early 30s. Conversely, a white youth born to a solid middle-class family, but with an IQ equivalently below average, faces a much higher risk of poverty, despite his more fortunate background. Among people who are both smart and well-educated, the risk of poverty approaches zero. When it comes to family matters, rumors of the death of the traditional family have much truth in them for some parts of white American society, those with low cognitive ability and little education, and much less truth for the college-educated and very bright Americans of all educational levels. In this instance, cognitive ability and education appear to play mutually reinforcing but also independent roles. For marriage, the general rule is that the more intelligent get married at higher rates than the less intelligent. This relationship, which applies across the range of intelligence, is obscured among people with high levels of education because college and graduate school are powerful delayers of marriage. Divorce has long been more prevalent in the lower socioeconomic and educational brackets, but this turns out to be better explained by cognitive level than by social status. Illegitimacy, one of the central social problems of the times, is strongly related to intelligence. White women in the bottom 5% of the cognitive ability distribution are 6 times as likely to have an illegitimate first child as those in the top 5%. 1 out of 5 of the legitimate first babies of women in the bottom 5% was conceived prior to marriage, compared to fewer than 1 out of 20 of the legitimate babies born to women in the top 5%. Even among young women who have grown up in broken homes and among young women who are poor, both of which foster illegitimacy, low cognitive ability further raises the odds of giving birth illegitimately. Low cognitive ability is a much stronger predisposing factor for illegitimacy than low socioeconomic background. At lower educational levels, a woman's intelligence again best predicts whether she will bear an illegitimate child. Toward the higher reaches of education, almost no white women are having illegitimate children, whatever their family background or intelligence. What is the reason for the extremely strong relationship between low IQ and illegitimacy within the population of poor white women? The possibilities bear directly on some of the core issues in the social policy debate. For example, many people have argued that the welfare system cannot really be a cause of illegitimacy because, in objective terms, the welfare system is a bad deal. It provides only enough to squeak by. It can easily trap young women into long-term dependence, and even poor young women would be much better off by completing their education and getting a job rather than having a baby and going on welfare. Therefore, the results we have analyzed could be interpreted as saying that the welfare system may be a bad deal, but it takes foresight and intelligence to understand why. For women without foresight and intelligence, it may seem to be a good deal. Hence, poor young women who are bright tend not to have illegitimate babies nearly as often as poor young women who are dull. Another possibility fits in with those who argue that the best preventative for illegitimacy is better opportunities. It is not the welfare system that is at fault, people say, but the lack of other avenues. However, poor young women who are bright are getting scholarships or otherwise having positive incentives offered to them, and they accordingly defer childbearing. Poor young women who are dull do not get such opportunities. They have nothing else to do, and so have a baby. The goal should be to provide them, too, with other ways of seeing their futures. The American family may be generally under siege, as people often say, but it is at the bottom of the cognitive ability distribution that its defenses are most visibly crumbling, and public policy